I do want to, well, I'll do that in a few minutes. Let us first bring on, for our invocation, Pastor Gregory Stenzel from the Good Shepherd Evangelical Lutheran Church. Pastor Stenzel.
Let us pray. O Lord God, give your blessings, we pray, to the work of the California Council of the Blind, that they may do it in faith and heartily as you would have them do.
Is there any prognosis?
And all of our powers of body and mind and soul, dear Lord, are yours.
Is there any prognosis we will be?
And we earnestly devote them to your service. Sanctify them. And sanctify the work of this group, this day, this weekend. Let it be work that is not done in slothfulness, but work that is done in fervent spirit. O Lord, bless the efforts of this community, that they may bring forth in it for themselves and for the larger community the fruits of true wisdom. Give us this day our daily bread, that we may be nourished in our body. Give us this day your Holy Spirit, that we may be nourished in our soul. Give us this day an opportunity for service, that we may live to your praise. We ask this through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor Stenzel. Pastor and his wife are going to stay here and watch our proceedings, so everybody be on your best behavior out there. Yeah, somebody said that. Okay, we are now ready for the presentation of our color guard. One more time, is Cindy Kaler in the room? Okay, we are going, yeah, well, I don't either, but that doesn't matter. We are now going to have the United States Navy Color Guard, along with Lee Morton, who will be doing our Pledge of Allegiance. So we'll bring on, and will you please stand for the United States Navy Color Guard.
We need to go deal with that.
March on. March. Ready. Hold. Present. Color.
And in just a moment, we will have Cindy Kaler do the presentation of the Pledge of Allegiance. Oh, I'm sorry, Lee Morton.
No, she's here.
Cindy's here? Okay.
So give her the mic.
All right.
Just trying to get up there.
Right here.
Thank you.
Welcome to San Diego. It is an honor to have the U.S. Navy present the colors for us. I have quite a bit of pride, especially because our daughter, Commander Kaler, is stationed here in Thailand. And so I have a big stake in the military. So please stand, and we are going to sing America the Beautiful.
Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay, we'll do the Pledge of Allegiance first. usually when we have when the colors are presented, then they do the either America the Beautiful or so anyway, we'll do
Cindy, whatever you'd like to do.
Okay. Would you please put your hand over your heart? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, everybody will, I hope no one will mind if we sing America the Beautiful. Oh, beautiful for spacious sky, forever waves of rain, for purple mountains' majesty, above a fluted plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and from thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
Thank you.
Remain standing.
Color guard, order colors. Ready, two, left, face. Forward, march.
All right, let's hear it for the United States Navy Color Guard and Cindy Keller. Thank you very much. Okay, the next item on the agenda, the next item on the agenda is going to be, and I'm gonna express my appreciation to Glenna Castle, Lee Morton, and the San Diego chapter for this particular item. We have a proclamation today from the mayor and entire city council of the city of San Diego, which is, oh, you can be seated, I'm sorry, I apologize. I did. The proclamation from Mayor and City Council of San Diego, and Ed Branch will read the proclamation. It's in that flat braille, as Kathy would say.
Resolution of the City Council, City of San Diego, California Council of the Blind Day, presented by the District 1 Council Member Sherry S. Leitner. Whereas the California Council of the Blind, CCB, has worked to increase the independence, equality of opportunity, and quality of life for all blind and visually impaired Californians since 1934, and whereas the Council is a nonprofit organization composed primarily of Californians who are blind or have impaired vision and who reflect the diversity of state, and whereas through local chapters such as the one in San Diego, CCB provides information and referral services, crisis and technical assistance, advocacy, leadership development, publications, mentoring for those with recent vision loss, emergency funds, accessible technology loans, and scholarships for visually impaired college students. And whereas the Council of the Blind serves as the principal organization representing the rights, needs, interests, and concerns of those who are blind or visually impaired before governmental agencies at all levels, and promotes employment, educational, and training opportunities, as well as economic security, to support self-esteem, self-determination, and pride among those incapable of full sight. And whereas through its efforts, CCB has influenced change in such areas and issues as civil rights, employment, rehabilitation, transportation, environmental access, travel, recreation, social security, and other benefits. And whereas members of the CCB believe that persons who are blind or visually impaired can and should take responsibility for their own lives by working collaboratively to create positive change for equal access. And whereas the California Council of the Blind will hold its fall 2010 convention at the San Diego Marriott La Jolla Hotel October 28th through October 31st, now therefore, be it resolved by the Council of the City of San Diego that this Council For and on behalf of the people of San Diego, does hereby proclaim October 29, 2010, to be California Council of the Blind Day in the City of San Diego. This is signed by the President of the Council, 7 Council members, and the Mayor. Resolution number 306171, approved by the Council on the 28th day of September 2010.
Okay, announcements.
Gene Lozano, I'm asking for the assistance of the members of the organization. You may or may not be aware of that the CCB has decided to enter a legal case against the Golden Gate Recreational National Area and the National Park Services for the lack of access to facilities in the San Francisco Bay Area around the bay. Many places like Fort Point, Alcatraz, a few others, Muir Woods, and it doesn't include Angel Island. I'm going to have to represent the organization in deposition in December, and I need to know, just as well as the disability rights advocates needs to know, any of you who have used the facilities in recent time, any of the parks around there, like the Presidio in the San Francisco, so forth, that have had problems with access, please contact me either here at the hotel in room 817, or you could email me at Lozanoe, that's Lozanoe at csus.edu, or you can leave a message at the 800 number at the CCB office, but I need information so that when I'm talking to the attorneys, that it will obviously appear that there is a problem and I need to have real cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Gene. All right, so we're going to get on to an exciting schedule today, and this first item is one that I just love. I know we can have these folks from, you know, we can have our legal beagle, we can have our rehab folks, but what I really like is the history. So our first speaker today to speak on the history of La Jolla, perspectives on the past, will be Carol Olton, a historian the La Jolla Historical Society. And without any further ado, let me bring on Carol Olton.
Thank you all. First of all, I want to compliment all of you on your beautiful dogs. They are so peaceful and quiet and just very gentle. The reason I'm talking about the dogs before I talk about La Jolla history is that I have a dog who is just 1 year old today, and he is a Samoyed puppy. He is boisterous and barking and constantly running around my house and chewing everything. So I am just admired of these lovely, quiet dogs. Now, let's start about La Jolla history. La Jolla actually began in 1887 when Frank Botsford bought a lot of land on the seacoast and started auctioning lots. He held his first big auction on April 30th, 1887. The thing that brought Mr. Botsford to La Jolla was the very thing that brings all of us there today and enjoy it as a lovely place to live. He saw the beautiful blue sky, the beautiful blue ocean. He saw the rocky sandstone cliffs with the hillsides rising above the sea. He saw gigantic rock formations that were huge, and some of them resembled things in nature like an alligator. Another one was called Cathedral Rock, and it just went on and on, you know, the beauty of La Jolla. But what Mr. Botsford had a problem with when he, in the early days, and trying to sell his lots and his land as subdivision, decision was that La Jolla also was a very, it was very distant from anything civilized. It was a long way from San Diego, and there was no transportation there. There was no communication with the outside world, hardly at all. And the landscape, while the sea and the sky were beautiful, the landscape itself was very desert-like and barren. There was only sagebrush growing and a few native plants and fauna. So with all of that, the development of La Jolla went along quite slowly at first. But people gradually did come along, and a railroad was established between San Diego and La Jolla that got you out there within an hour for about, I think, 50 cents both ways. And so a lot of people came from San Diego mainly just to enjoy the seaside and picnic along the beaches in the early days of the 1890s. But gradually, they began to appreciate the climate and the seaside environment, and they began to build beach cottages, very small beach cottages, one bedroom, one bath in the bungalow style. They were single story, very snugly cozy little places by the sea. And as the beach cottages were built, more and more people came, and they became permanent residents. Something happened in 1896 in La Jolla that was to change its history in the future very much, and that was the arrival of the neighbor heiress, Ellen Browning Scripps. She came in 1896. She was 61 years old. She had made much money with her brothers and half-brothers on newspaper operations, mainly in the Midwest. And so she came to La Jolla thinking she would retire, and she built a beautiful house by the sea, somewhat Victorian in nature, and it had a turret and a tower and a terrace and balconies overlooking the beautiful sea, and she named it South Moulton Villa, and it was named after the street on which she was born in London, South Moulton Street. And so Ellen Browning Scripps came and built this beautiful big house, unlike the other beach cottages, and she started looking around. She wanted to do some philanthropy, and of course La Jolla was ripe for philanthropy because it was just a kind of barren place with beach cottages. And she saw a great need for education and cultural institutions. She wanted to have some schools. She wanted to have a hospital. And so in her generous efforts, she used her money to build schools and a wonderful hospital. And she built the La Jolla Recreation Center, which we still have today and use very much every day. And also the La Jolla Women's Club. Most of these buildings were built about 1915, and they were designed by a now famous architect named Irving Gill. Mr. Gill worked almost exclusively for quite some time with Ellen Browning Scripps in creating this beautiful landscape that we now have in La Jolla. And in these years, he was using a form of construction called tilt-up concrete. And the idea was that the walls of these buildings would be actually poured in forms on the ground. They would be left to dry, and then with the help of manpower and horses, and at that time there would have been some locomotion, some vehicles that would work with them too, trucks, and they would be tilted up when they were dried and set up and become the walls of the building. And they were quite beautiful because Mr. Gill always designed the forms with lovely arches and colonnades, and we still have much evidence of that architecture that forms the central cultural zone of La Jolla in the present day. Miss Scripps continued with her philanthropic efforts until her death in 1932. But meanwhile, because of all of her influence and the building she created, La Jolla was becoming a very prosperous, more resort-type town. And in the 1920s, before her death in 1932, we witnessed the construction of many of what we now have as our most beautiful hotels. The La Valencia, the Casa Manana was built as a resort hotel along the seaside, and it became a popular place for social soirees and cultural activities, and many people came from all around the world to enjoy the beautiful seaside facilities of La Jolla. Another thing that happened in the 1920s in La Jolla is that many of the areas that now contain some of the wealthiest neighborhoods were built up on the hillside in the Muirlands. In 1926, a man named Muir, who was not related in any way to the man who created the Muir Woods and helped build those facilities, he came to La Jolla and he built a large estate for himself. It was designed by an architect named Edward Ulrich, and it is still there in the present day and remains a private residence. Another area that was developed in the 1920s was the La Jolla Shores area, and our beach and tennis club was created. The La Jolla Country Club came around at about the same time. And so in the 1920s, there was a lot of wealth, actually, very prosperous time, and La Jolla reflected the wealth in what was built and also in not only residential but also in the commercial zones. Girard Avenue, which now contains a lovely group of shops and boutiques, and we even have a hardware store still as well. Anyway, all of that kind of came around and was developed in the 1920s when a lot more people started moving to La Jolla. 1929, you know, that was the big stock market crash, and La Jolla was affected tremendously, as was everybody else in the country. And a lot of our building and development simply stopped. And the 1930s were kind of a quiet time in La Jolla, as they were around the country. But the war came along, the Second World War, obviously, in the 1940s, and many troops were in the La Jolla areas in various camps. Facilities were created for training the troops here along the seaside. And so a lot of the soldiers that came to La Jolla in the 1940s to train here actually returned as residents with their families after the war. And so we had another great period of growth in La Jolla in the late 1940s and the succeeding decade, the 1950s. I wanted to come a little bit up to date, more up to date, into the 1960s, because the 1960s in La Jolla were a tremendous time. University of California, San Diego was created north of our village area, and the Salk Institute also was built and designed by the architect Louis Kahn. And of course, it was the facility that was the residence and the scientific workspace for Dr. Jonas Salk, who had discovered the polio vaccine. I think the 1970s and 80s, moving on to present day still, witnessed a lot of challenges in La Jolla. We were threatened by a lot of really big commercial buildings that didn't really keep in character with the village state that we all felt somehow needed to be preserved. And the malls started happening around the area, and the business community got a little scared that all business was going to move out of town. But thankfully, that didn't really happen. I mean, there were some challenging things that happened in our streets and in our residential neighborhoods, but La Jolla survived. And I think what I want to bring around, we were talking about Ellen Browning Scripps, and she always saw La Jolla as one of the most beautiful places that was in need of preservation. And in 1899, she wrote a little story here, a piece. It was called The Future of La Jolla. Now, this is, you have to remember, this is 1899. We haven't reached the 20th century yet. But she wrote, "It lies with us residents and owners of La Jolla to make our jewel what we will, only keeping it always in harmony with its glorious natural setting. To do this, we must cultivate ourselves in our own hearts and lives, the spirit of all harmony and beauty and spirituality. From the upbuilding of character goes the outbuilding of beauty." And I think here with our La Jolla Historical Society, we are very much trying to preserve the beauty of La Jolla and preserve some of its really lovely architecture. And our society was founded in 1963. And with that, I'm going to turn the mic over to our executive director, John Bolthouse, who will tell us something about the history of our organization and its efforts to preserve La Jolla.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Okay. I think what we'll do...
There is a question.
Oh, good.
There is one.
Good.
Right here.
Okay, Gene Lozano. I was wondering if you might be, if it's not going to be part of your presentation, talk about Mount Soledad and the cross, and also about the little people legend up there.
Yeah, I was just about ready to get to the little people. We'll talk about the cross later. That's a little bit more serious subject, I think. The little people that Gene is referring to are the Munchkin houses that were built on Hillside Drive. They were actually designed in the 1930s by an architect named Cliff May. And he had an idea to actually nestle these houses into the hillside rather than build them on top of the hillside. Consequently, he created very small doors in the houses. You could hardly squeeze through if you were an average tall person. And and this was about the time that The Wizard of Oz came out, also in 1939, I believe. So consequently, La Jolleans started referring to these four houses that were built on Hillside Drive as the Munchkin houses. Now, there's another kind of funny legend connected with those houses up there. The story is told in Al Jean Harmon's book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz, that these houses were actually rented for a short time by the midgets who played the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz. And the story is told that the midgets, who I think were originally from Barnum and Bailey Circus, were running around on the set at The Wizard of Oz, and they were just creating hazards in filming and interrupting with the filming of the movie. So he decided he would get these midgets shipped out of town for a while. So he had connections with Cliff May, supposedly, in Hollywood. And so May had said, well, you know, I have these houses we've just built, and they're, you know, they're for small people because I have small doors and small windows, et cetera, et cetera. And the story is told that then a number of the midgets that were in the filming of the making of The Wizard of Oz were transferred to La Jolla and lived for a bit of time in what became known as the Munchkin Houses. This is a legend. Don't take it for fact. Gene's other question concerned Mount Soledad.
Yes.
As you know, it is a very high mountain overlooking the entire city of San Diego, and was a very popular spot to drive to when I was courting my husband in the 60s, and we would drive up there and, well, look at the stars for a while, among other things. But through the years, Mount Soledad has always had a cross on top. And the cross through the past decade, actually two decades, I think, has become a great subject of controversy because it does represent a Christian cross. And there's a great deal of debate over whether or not the cross should be there. I don't believe it's been totally resolved in the courts yet. But it the cross, you know, is... whoops, Sue. Yeah. The lights go out. We weren't supposed to broach that subject, maybe, huh?
The lights didn't notice a thing.
Hold on. We'll get the lights on, I guess.
There we go.
The Munchkin did it.
I'm glad we have these wonderful dogs here. Okay. Okay, lights are back on, full force, there we go. One of the other things that's very important about Mount Soledad is that Charles Lindbergh, who flew the transatlantic in 1927, the first to do so, he actually learned to fly gliders off of Mount Soledad, and he became quite known for his abilities not only to fly regular airplanes across the Atlantic and all of his flying ability, but he also became known as quite an interesting man and glider pilot by flying off of Mount Soledad. And also his wife, Anna Lindbergh, our executive director, has reminded me that she also did some sailplanes off of Mount Soledad and also flew from, I think, Mount Soledad to, was it Del Mar, John?
Yep.
Yeah, on one occasion.
Okay.
Okay, I think we do have another question.
One more question here.
Yeah.
Keith Johnson. Where did the name La Jolla come from? The way it's spelled is not the way, well, never mind. But where did where is the origination of the name La Jolla?
The name La Jolla, it is, we have two interpretations of the name La Jolla. One is that it was originally named Hoya, H-O-Y-A, which I believe is the Spanish word for caves. And the other one is La Jolla, because it means the jewel.
Right.
And so you can, in these two interpretations are reported in Pat Shacklin's main history book on La Jolla called La Jolla, The Story of a Community. And she researched that, the name quite well. And that's the two interpretations we have today.
Now, the spelling, the original Spanish spelling for La Jolla is not what you use today.
I am not familiar with the Spanish language, so I couldn't say that for sure.
Yeah, but this is what I understand, too.
All right, thank
but
you
I don't
very
know,
much.
Though, so. That's all.
That's it. Carol, I want to thank you very, very much for that entertaining information on the city of La Jolla.
I was wondering, do we have just a few minutes for Unbolt House to tell you a little bit about the history of our organization, which was founded in 1963?
Okay. Absolutely.
John?
I will be brief because I'm very interested in everything else that Carol has to say about. Every time Carol and I go to a presentation to great groups like this, I learn something new about La Jolla. And I'd almost prefer just to shut up and listen to her talk a little bit more. But very briefly, the Historical Society has been around since 1963. We have approximately 900 members in the community. And that's, lots of wows I hear out there. For a community of our size of about 40,000, and for an organization of our size, which has a budget of about $400,000, that you can really get a sense of the incredible support we have in the community. So we're very proud of that. We are a nonprofit 501c3, just like the council here, and we have a staff of 5, 2 full-time and 2 and 3 part-time. We have almost 200 volunteers who volunteer for lots of various different things that we do, for events and helping us do research in our archives and build and develop exhibits and serve as docents and tour guides. So when you come back to San Diego and La Jolla, we welcome you to La Jolla to take a tour and get a sense of what this great town is all about. Again, thank you very much for this invitation. We're humbled and honored to be invited today, and enjoy your stay in San Diego and La Jolla.
Thank you very, very much to both of you. I think we are enjoying our stay in La Jolla.
Yes.
So, okay, is Terry Grossman in the room? Terry is not yet here. Okay. Is Wesley Johnson and Nikki Warren in the room? Okay. All right. Is Bonnie Rennie in the room?
Well,
then why don't you come up and give, you wanted a few minutes on the agenda, and why don't you come up and do that right now? If you're prepared to do that. 5 minutes or so.
Well, this worked out great. I prepared a speech, and we don't have time for me to do that, so I'm going to wing it, and that'll be even better. I'm here to do a sales pitch, unabashedly. But I'm not embarrassed to do it, because this is to sell you something that many of you in this room need. Now, we all are proud of CCB, proud of so many things. It cares about people of all ages and backgrounds. We love diversity. We want our organization to grow and to stay strong. Well, I'm here to mention one way that we can help do that. I'm here on behalf of the Seniors with Vision Loss Committee, and I'm here to ask you to share some of your creative juices with us over a period of time. The more help we have, the more things we can do. Now, there are two categories of people that we want to serve in our committee. One of them you've seen us write about and talk about before. Those are the newly blind or visually impaired seniors. They've spent most of their lives as sighted people, and now they're learning to cope with legal blindness, and many of them are very scared, and many of them sure don't want to hear the word blind. They and their families might benefit from and they might be willing to look into what we have to offer one day, but we're a long way from that, most of them right now. How are we going to reach out to them? The other group is not so often talked about that our Seniors with Vision Loss Committee is here for, and that is us. Those of us that are longtime CCBers and well adjusted to our vision loss. Many of us have had vision loss all of our lives, but now we're aging, and the good and the bad of that, we have many challenges that we didn't have before. All kinds of them, retirement. Some of you are about ready to retire or have retired recently, like me. And then there are other challenges, though, the income challenges. Usually we have less, not more. I don't know about you, but the health challenges, which we sure don't want to talk about, and travel and leisure pursuit challenges, they change, that's all. And we want to be here for us. Now, I think we in CCB don't like to talk about aging too much. It makes us uncomfortable. But let's face it, a lot of us in this room are either seniors or we're getting perilously close. Well, what can we do about it? And why are we pitching the Seniors with Vision Loss Committee? And I'm not going to have time to go into everything. I was going to tell you about the great things we might do. We still need people to help do volunteer things that we're already doing, be resource people in your community, to informally be prepared to share resources with people that you run into, or that, you know, there's always the person that has a blind relative that tells you about them. That's someone you can help. Just integrating in our community, like the Senior Center, we do a lot of public education. We plan convention programs. I'm going to make a quick plug for the program at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you've secretly wondered how you were going to deal with independence in your home to remain at home if you have health challenges later on, and you want to come to our program at 9 tomorrow, we have a good program for you. We want to do more stuff and other stuff. Oh, and you can also help us distribute our literature, Failing Sight and the Family Plight, and the new booklet that we're working on. Those are things that we're already doing. And we're a small committee, we have great people, but we really need more help. The website we're working on, the CCB website, it's growing and changing. We want to do some things with that website where you would come in. I'd like to do a rotating picture gallery where we'd have some of our wonderful members doing things that will amaze the public, though they don't amaze us, and with little explanations of what we are doing and how CCB has benefited us. might be not too bad for a fundraising ally, don't you think? Also, things like tips for seniors and using the arts in creative ways on the website. So whatever talents you have, probably you could fit in. Now, this is stuff over time, and it will all depend on who is here to help us and how dedicated we are, how organized, and how good our program is. Other things we can do, greeting cards, and I have to get this in because Kathy Skivers really inspired this idea, even if she knows that. Giving CCB positive message greeting cards to people who we know who could use our message, short, easy way of doing that. Take a lot of work, a lot of planning, probably some grant writing, a good thing to do. Many other things I just don't have time to go into it. I hope it piqued your interest. I want to challenge people, though, one other thing to get this done. We need to increasingly work together among our committees and affiliates in CCB. So I challenge a couple of these committees I'm going to name to think about in the future how you can work with us and we can work with you more effectively. Public relations, membership, AMC is a big one, CCCLV, and the technology committee. You might think of some others. The more we work together, the better. Your issues are our issues, and I think that's my point. Now, we've all banded together as students. A lot of us that have been around a long time, we know how effective that is when we advocate together, work together. Job seeking, we did the same thing. We networked and we encouraged each other. This stage of life is really no different, and I'm to sell you on the idea, A, it's okay to be a senior. B, we can accomplish a lot more if we have more of us helping to do the work. And C, if we work together among the committees and affiliates, which will take some planning and some real creativity, I know we can increasingly make a difference and hopefully, if not get new members into CCB, really be able to, what do you do when you don't look yourself in the mirror? Pat ourselves in the back and say, you really made a difference and helped some people. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Okay, thank you, Bonnie. And I just want to say, these are wonderful words, but if all you guys do is just sit there and think what wonderful words Bonnie just spoke and don't act on them, then they're wasted words. So let's really, you know, take this to heart. Bonnie is really trying hard with that committee of hers, and we all stepped up to the plate. So I commit to you, Bonnie, when I've become a has-been in a couple months, to spend some more time on senior issues. Okay, I want to introduce, before we get to our next part, want to introduce our new audio crew. We have two gentlemen, one from the north, one from the south. It's going to be very cool. Our Northern California person is Brian Roberts. Brian has 7 years experience working in the audio field. I learned from Lily that he's actually an incredible whiz kid. They knew one another in college, and he is apparently knows all, just about all there is to know in this area, and he's already taught us a lot of things that we needed to know. And he currently works as a consultant, in a sound consultant in Antioch, California. So let's hear it for Brian. Brian, you want to say thanks?
Is Brian back on the way out?
And that's what we're going to do. Oh, okay. Brian is elsewhere, as you always expect. His gentleman working with him, is he in the room?
Yes.
Okay. Jason is here. So let me also introduce to you Jason Boyle. He is currently taking classes here at Miramar College. He is working in the recording area, and he is working in recording mix and whole other areas that I know nothing about, and I won't even explain them. He's in several bands, and he moved out here to the East Coast to work in recording. So let's hear it for Jason Boyle. Jason?
I'm not one for many words.
That's good enough for me. Thank you very much, Jason. We really appreciate both of you. These guys are doing a crack-up job, and they're giving Ed some lessons he never thought yet. So we're gonna have, I think, improved technology, improved systems over the next year or so. I think we're really gonna make a step forward. Okay. Let's go on to our next speakers, and our next presentation is called Welcome to Accessible San Diego, and we have present to us today Wesley Johnson, who is the president of Accessible San Diego, and Nikki Warren, who is an administrative assistant, who somebody likes in Accessible San Diego. So let's take it away, Wesley and Nikki.
We're wondering, can everybody hear me in the back of the room? Wave your hands back there. Yeah. All right. Well, we want to extend a warm welcome to everybody to San Diego. And we've been working at improving accessibility for 23 years. We're a very unique little nonprofit information center for travelers with disabilities. And we are very happy to have you come to our little town. Even though it was raining the last couple of days, your vibrant energy had drove the rain away, and it was a sunny day today. Thank you very much. We were at a conference for the blind. It was called CSUN last March. And we had our world famous Access in San Diego guides in our hands. And we were trying to hand them out, and everybody, most of them had a vision disability. And they kept telling me, Wes, we can't read your guide. You got to find another way of presenting it. So we have very limited money, like everybody else. We went to our partners at MTS, the bus company here in San Diego, and we said, can you help us get our guide in an alternative format? And MTS came back and they said, yes, we will provide you these discs. So I got these discs in my hand, and I'm going to put them at the back of the table for you on the way out. So this is a very big plus. So they're on little thumb discs. You can plug them in your USB port and find good access information. So that's we are getting there with our limited funds, but we really want to say welcome to San Diego. My assistant Nikki gets to talk now, and she gets to talk about what's on the disc because she's been uploading stuff on the disc for the last 3 days. So I'm going to let Nikki say some welcome to you now. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nikki, and thank you for the big welcome, and welcome back to you. Welcome to San Diego for those who are here for the first time or who haven't been here for the first time, and those who live here, hello. finally, as Wes said, we have the sunshine that we can boast and everything. So you have a full schedule on the convention, however, enjoy the city. And the disc we prepared, there are 5 things on the desk, and 4 of them are Word documents, so I'm sure you'll be able to access that in every ways. For screen readers, don't worry, we don't have tables. Just the fanciest thing I have on it is a bullet and hyperlink. So don't worry, no tables. And for those who would use magnification, the font I used is 18. So that's the minimum, right? For large print. So I passed that. And the fifth thing on the disk is a PDF document. That is the full access guide. And I tried to find a way to make the whole thing in Braille or large print. However, I could not make it. So if there's, you know, of somebody who's very generous and want to help Accessible San Diego, let us know, because we want to make the 2012 access guide in Braille or large print in time for CSUN, or the CCB convention if you guys are coming back to San Diego next year. And I hope that's the case, because I don't want to travel around. I love San Diego so much, I don't want to leave. Okay, now let's go into what's on the disk. Okay, you know it's a Word document. You know the PDF is full access guide. But the first one, the first Word document is named one, welcome from ASD president. And that's what it says. Just like the file name says, that's the message from Mr. Wes Johnson.
Yeah.
And the second one is named two contact lists. The contact list comes in handy when you come to San Diego next time, or you decide to venture out of the convention hotel this time, because it has all the phone numbers, website and Facebook links to the major attractions, shopping malls, and movie theaters. Movie theaters, I only put the ones that have the district descriptive audio movies, which is AMC theaters, Fashion Buy, Mission Buy. And and yes, we do have MTS, the transportation. We, you know, in order to go somewhere, we need the transportation, right? So we have the our big sponsor MTS. MTS stands for Metropolitan Transit System, which is public transportation. So we have the information on bus and trolley and the phone number. And we have, just in case you are using MTS Access, the paratransit system, we have the phone number there, and Cloud9 Super Shuttle and the cab company. The bus lines around the hotel are 150, 50, 41, and 30. And unfortunately, on Saturdays and Sundays, 150 and 50 do not run. Those are the express buses. And so that's the second file. The third file are the things to do in San Diego. And I might be biased because I picked those places. So the things I think are interesting are on it. But, and of course, you know, who doesn't like San Diego Zoo? Who doesn't like SeaWorld? The cool thing that the San Diego Zoo started, in the past, I used to receive a phone call from a blind couple who visited San Diego and wanted to go to the zoo, but they didn't have any sighted person with them. So they would call us or the Center for the Blind and say, hey, do you have any volunteer to take us around the zoo? And sometimes we could fill the need, sometimes we couldn't. But now the zoo is doing it. So if you have a plan to go to the zoo, let them know. Yeah, that's cool, isn't it? So we have the phone number who to call at the zoo. Ask for Linda when you call the zoo, and call at least 1 week in advance so they can arrange somebody. And these people, the guides in the zoo, they have a training. They went through the training, so they can describe things better to blind and visually impaired people. So, and I haven't taken advantage of this yet. So, you know, I live in San Diego, so if you want to go to the zoo with me, let me know. Be my guest. More the merrier. And and I am also talking to the USS Midway Aircraft Carrier Museum. Yes. And by the way, Aircraft Carrier Museum is very close to the airport or the Greyhound Amtrak station. So you may have time to do that this Sunday afternoon. Even though they haven't set up the tour guide yet, have the cool audio tour. So in the family audio tour is supposed to be narrated by like the cartoon characters or the sailors who used to be on the Midway. So that should be cool.
It is.
Is it? Yeah. Ah, see, you're ahead of me. And for those who like shopping, the closest shopping mall from here is UTC, University Town Center.
Yes.
Westfield. Yeah, right across the street. And don't ask me how to get there on foot because I'm not an orientation and mobility teacher. But if you want to call ahead, the Westfield Shopping Mall phone number is 858-546-8858, and they should be able to help you. So that's the third thing. And the fourth, let's see, one, two, three, four. What is the fourth? Oh, yeah, fourth one is the last but not the least. A restaurant with Braille, the list of restaurants with Braille menu. And, and those on the list are at least, you know, somebody actually not just calling and say, hey, do you guys have Braille menu? Yeah, okay, you're on the list. Not like that. Either myself or my friend actually went there and touched the Braille menu at least once. So they have it. So if the waitress says, you know, I don't know, make sure that, hey, you guys gave me before. Because I had one time, it was at the Applebee's. Applebee's are usually pretty good. But then they gave me the Braille menu and I was reading it. And then I ordered the menu, business as usual, it was cool. And then the next waitress came to correct the menu. And then they wouldn't take that Braille menu because so I said, okay, you know, here's your menu too. And the guy said, what? Oh, really? We have that? I thought you made it. So, you know, the guy thought, I personally made it for myself and brought it in. You know, if I could do that myself, I was in some in another business. But those are the things that I have on the disc. So I hope you take the disc with you and share it with your friends. So everybody, you know, everyone can come to San Diego and enjoy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Wesley. Thank you, Nikki. Wait. Questions for Wesley and Nikki?
Hi, guys. Lisa Gordon from the Bay Area. This is such a neat idea. I wonder how this got started and how people in different regions could get something like this together. What a great resource for people.
Well, we appreciate the little praise. It didn't come easy. It's hard every year to try to find out local resources to get rolling. It's very tough. If you have a good visitors bureau, you've got interested local hotels to work with you on information funding, that's a good starting point. Another good starting point is work with your local governments. You get a city council person behind you or the mayor behind you, you can do some big things with some CDBG type money to get it going. But anyway, if you're an area that's likes to promote tourism, it's a pretty good match because you identified 18% of the U.S. population have disabilities. That's where a major overlooked market is, and they may be interested in that also. So hopefully I've given you the answer.
Okay. I want to thank both of you very, very much. What a fascinating concept. Lisa asked a very good question. I think all the state could use such a nonprofit. Is Terry Grossman in the room?
That'd be great.
Okay, Terry's not. Okay, let's go on then to our next speaker. I need to get mine to get here. Thank you. I'm in a position where I just have too many notes. Okay. I am very excited to have our next speaker. The title of the presentation is Adaptive Martial Arts Practice, The Path to Inner Strength and Mental Focus, a Satori Experience. He's got a great workshop for tomorrow. I'm going to be part of that workshop, I'm telling you that. And so I'm going to introduce to you, and I want to give a little information about him, about Mario Schaap, Certified Instructor of Kyusaw Neem. So let me briefly tell you something about Mario. Since 2005, he's been teaching the self-defense program at the Blind Community Center of Diego. He is the head instructor. That's right. Let's hear it for those guys. He is the head instructor at the Blind Community Martial Arts. Mr. Schaap teaches after-school karate programs at local elementary schools in San Diego and is a certified Zen Touch Shiatsu technician. He is also a successful competitor at regional, national, and international martial arts tournament. He holds 6 national titles and won the silver medal at the first Open Black Belt World Championships in Toronto in traditional Korean forms and a 3rd place in kickboxing point sparring. Mario Schaap has traveled the world for many years studying various styles and methods in the fighting arts. And with that, let's hear it for a true pioneer, Mario Schaap.
Wow. I'd like to say hello to everyone and welcome in San Diego. I'm so glad to see actually many of our students here and many people I haven't seen before. I feel very welcome, and I'd like to share some things with you that you may not know. We always speak about martial arts as a thing just for sighted people or people that are able to do things. It is true, though, when I speak to other people that we, for example, have a school here in San Diego for the blind community, they look at me with these big eyes and say, how is it possible? And I look back and I say, it's not so difficult because it's actually easier than teaching an average person. Because there's one thing they have, the will to learn and dedication to it. And that is something that has driven me to come every day when we have class, go there. Even though sometimes I have a bad day, the moment I walk in, everything changes. I'd like to share a little bit more about how do we recognize adaptive martial arts and maybe reflect on your everyday routines, your daily lives. Of course, you can actually sample it today, not just listening to me, but checking in with yourself. By breathing in and out, by breathing in through your nose, by breathing out through your mouth. When I speak and you focus on your breathing, perhaps in the end you don't know what I've spoken about, but maybe your breathing has improved. All right.
It's funny, isn't it?
If you take my classes, you know I'm known to be a funny guy. So let me start. Adaptive martial arts practice the path to inner strength and mental focus. The question is, what is adaptive martial arts? It's the general martial arts modified or adapted to fit the needs and capabilities of the individual practitioner. Martial arts have been around since the first time someone threw a stone at his opponent, or when the first physical conflict took place. It's not sure how long ago the humans started developing technologies and methods to protect themselves, their families, towns, cities, villages, against attackers in a far more organized fashion. But it has been documented that about 4,000 years ago in old Korea, different tribes have practiced the first sophisticated martial arts. From being organized grew the need to simplify the fighting methods and establish curriculum to be able to teach these techniques to many people. Martial arts was developed out of the need to stay alive and healthy. It thrived because of the successful application and utilization of different defensive offensive maneuvers. At about 2,000 years ago, there was a shift in the evolution of combat. In order to create great warriors and successful armies, the practice of strength kicking was no longer the main emphasis of training. Over the years, joint manipulations, leg locks, and pressure point control tactics were incorporated in daily practice. As we have in our school, if you ask my students, that is something we do a lot. We do pressure point manipulations, joint locks, and you name it. The history of smart fighting goes back as far as the year 300, when the Korean monks defended themselves against thugs with pressure point manipulations and took them out without any blood being shed. Today, we don't practice martial arts to face the enemy in deadly combat, but it is still necessary to be able to defend oneself. There are countless stories of innocent people being attacked and put in danger without them having a slight chance to do anything about it. At least with the ability to perform self-defense techniques, the chances of getting hurt are much less. Since 5 years, we are teaching martial arts to the students at the Blind Community Center, San Diego. At first, it was purely self-defense. Then we realized that we are missing the point of martial arts practice: to improve life quality and promote better health. These are some big words when we have to consider that most of our students are dealing with disability, bad health, and even terminal illness. So why would anyone still find the strength to keep on coming to class and do the exercises, even though it might hurt doing it? The answer sits deep in the heart and soul of each student. It is what has changed for the individual and how much improvement could be seen in the everyday performance of tasks and chores, as simple as cooking, going outside, going shopping, talking to people, laying down, sitting down, standing up, walking. If a person practices certain movements and behavioral patterns on a daily basis, in a few months' time it has become body memory, and it doesn't acquire the nervous system to initiate response, so to speak, reflexes. The body has learned to take care of itself. Adaptive martial arts have been developed over the years because of need to educate students with all kinds of different abilities and special needs. What works for a sighted person can work just as fine for a vision impaired or blind student. But the teaching of these subjects must be modified to enable each practitioner to learn with the best results possible. So practicing adaptive martial arts means actually nothing different than practicing martial arts. With the right attitude and mindset, everyone can learn the secrets of the ancient fighting methods and philosophies. Philosophy in martial arts is the main vessel of education. Understanding some of the ancient philosophies also means being able to look inside oneself and find ways to deal with everyday problems, worries, anxiety. There are things that we speak about in class, yin and yang, there's eight concepts. Those are concepts that we teach the class by, and a student can change their life accordingly. Eight concepts are courage, concentration, endurance, honesty, humility, control of power, tension, relaxation, speed control. When I teach a class, those are concepts I bring up very often, and I use the vocalization of those words to make a person stronger and more confident. When a person starts getting into practicing all these new techniques and different methods of movement, usually it is very hard and awkward at first and requires good dedication and focus to get it right. What seems to be a piece of cake for the advanced student is nearly impossible to do for the novice. That is why we are using sophisticated teaching methods in adaptive martial arts training. We as instructors had to realize that we couldn't conduct the class as if we were teaching at the average karate school. Our objective had to become to care for the individual. And that's exactly what is the heart and soul of adaptive martial arts: to care for the individual. Under the guidance of the caring instructor, the student can explore his or her abilities and how the body reacts to different exercises. Only with the input of the student can we as instructors continue to teach all subjects of martial arts to the students with several disabilities. Modifications and adaptations are what make it all work. We take the technique out of the general curriculum and manufacture a way to perform it so that from 20 students in a room, all can execute it, but it doesn't necessarily look alike. But it is effective for each of them. One of the biggest problems in building confidence and strength is the awareness that all students get frustrated about their progress and skill development. It is something we have to live with. I have to accept it as instructor. I realize there's nothing I can do about it. It is as it is. We learn to sense this and work on it as best as we can. There's a lot of psychology in teaching martial arts people, especially when they have challenges from the moment the sun arises till night falls, day after day. In our classes, I focus on creating a carefree environment where it matters how the student practices, but it is not important what outcome it has. My expectations are high. People will tell you that. But my attachment to the results are very, very low. It's all good. That allows us to work together and find a way to improve every person's technique, performances, and life vision. There's so much more to practicing fighting methods than fighting. As a matter of fact, it has very little to do with fighting others, but everything to do with becoming a better to fight the internal fight. Off. I can't versus I can. I am not able versus I can do it. So how do we achieve to build inner strength and better focus? We are painting a beautiful picture. With the help of our students, we create a personal environment or space where we can practice in harmony and inner peace and yet exist as a martial arts group. We interact with each other and support each other. Our biggest quality as practitioners and instructors of the adaptive martial arts is our compassion for each other. When we care for our training partner, we take the next to care for ourselves. When we help the person that has a problem with some technique or exercise, we actually help to improve our own martial arts performance. Tomorrow I have there's a seminar, and I hope most of you can be there. I would love to see all of you. And some of these exercises I'm mentioning right now will be there, they will be pressed tomorrow, and I will be elaborating about it more and more tomorrow. But crucial part of our training is distance control drills, distance awareness exercises, the internal compass and directional awareness, sound, smell, and height perception to figure out where a potential danger could be. Those are exercises that we have to stimulate the senses and awareness. We have exercises to build inner strength. By inner strength, we are speaking about the consolidation of one's life force or chi to perform incredible tasks. Just some to mention: unbendable arm exercise, moving hands like clouds, qigong, rooting or grounding. To improve focus, all one needs to do is direct the inner focus to the external influence and utilize all senses available to assess the situation. We speak about the center of orientation, the head with the nose as the center point. Since we are dealing with different kinds of vision impairments, it would not be possible to rely on eyesight, but rather to rely on a central perception. For most novice martial arts students, it is difficult to understand the head turn as initiation for the turning of the body. In adaptive martial arts, this concept is what allows us to get the information needed to figure out what is the distance, where is the direction, and even what kind of conflict are we looking at without jeopardizing a solid foundation or base. Over the years, I have noticed that students with vision impairment or blindness tend to have a superficial base or foundation, which means if there's conflict, these people most likely lose their balance. In training, we exercise certain drills to learn how to ground, to learn how to establish a better base, a better balance. Conflict is not only a life-threatening situation or a self-defense situation, but rather everything that throws off the balance and focus of a person. In daily practice, we work with situations like that and role play these potential situations, because the more the student is exposed to these kind of threats, the better the student is prepared. After training adaptive martial arts for some time, I can see improvements. It blows me away when I see that a person that is used to walk very careful and slow is now moving with confidence and purpose. We have a very tough challenge as students and instructors of adaptive martial arts. We are not only practicing a few moves for an hour and go home. No. We have to change our lives and try to incorporate all these fundamentals of our training in daily routines. Because the body has to be reconnected with its center, and that is a very difficult task to do. We speak of body awareness and focus. But tell that to someone that has trouble to even get around, someone that is scared to walk outside because of what could happen. There are so many things that could be of harm and so many people that may pose a threat. It is my task to teach students that are disabled, blind, hearing impaired, or have mental challenges that life is worth living in the best way every individual can make it work. It is not up to me to stand there side by side every minute. All I can do is open the door for what is possible and how anyone's life be lived to the fullest, even though there are limitations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The president is going to take the prerogative to ask the first question. If for those of us who live in other parts of the state, let's say we were able to find someone that was interested in taking on a challenge this and teaching this sort of class, could they network with you to get some guidance on how you know, I'm sure you had to learn as you went sort of thing, and it was a challenge to you to formulate the best strategies that you now use. Is there a way they can network with you to see how it might be done? Because I imagine there's a lot of folks who might want to do it and probably can't figure out how they would do it.
As a matter of fact, I'm still looking to connect with different martial arts schools and organizations that are dealing with all kinds of disabilities to start teaching or to incorporate other instructors. I believe there are certain organizations that are teaching martial arts to people with disability in the Northern California part, especially in the Bay Area. You will find some of them. Sacramento, I've seen some of it. In Los Angeles, I know that, some, for example, in the martial arts like jiu-jitsu, you could go to a martial arts school and talk to the instructor. If he is open-minded, he will have you. If he's closed-minded, you have no business being there because it's not giving you the care that you need. So please, if you feel like you like to do this, contact me and I see if I can find someone that will work with you. There's a question over there.
Okay, we have another question. We'll get a mic to you.
Okay.
Here's my card. Second.
Thank you, sir. Hi, this is Beth Berenson from the Lighthouse in San Francisco, and we do teach mega self-defense for the visually impaired, and you know, I can't do this without making a plug for my agency and my creation list. So I do a listing each week all about Northern California entertainment and recreation, and I do put it on CCBL, but if you'd like to get it any other way, shoot me an email. You can find me all over the place this weekend. And good job.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lee Morton, and I'm the executive director of the Blind Community Center, and we're the ones that hold the martial arts class. And I just want to put a quick plug. I believe when the convention was here 15 years ago, Aaron Fleck was the director of the Blind Community Center then. Then we were the Blind Recreation Center. We changed name to Blind Community Center because we want to be a little more than just fun and games. And I'm also one of the students in the class. I also gave go-ahead for the class to meet because I felt this was one way of representing who we were, that we want to offer recreation, but recreation that can be meaningful in our lives. Of course, we have learned some great defense techniques, but I would say we've learned just more about awareness of ourselves and awareness of our environment that you just can't put a price tag on. We've also been involved, we've been in competitions, we've won some trophies, and just to have someone who maybe is a grandmaster in a martial art come up to you and say, you have made my day, you have really inspired me to go on to new heights. It means a lot because so often in the world we're getting, you know, you get a lot of perception of, we really don't want you to participate. And then when someone comes up to you and says, you've made a difference in my life because you have taken on this sport, it really makes you decide to go on and keep on trucking away and martial arts and all the other things that you do in life. So I would hope that some of you who can come to the workshop, please join us, and that you can get something going like this in your areas. Thank you very much for listening to our presentation today.
Thank you, Lee. The time is 8 o'clock for tomorrow's workshop, and so I would invite many of you, we have room, to sign up, so please do that. Okay. I think we have time for one more question. 8 a.m. 8 p.m. is time for our banquet. So, and if you're not at the banquet, Beth, I'll tell that to the lighthouse.
No.
Okay.
One hand just went up.
Do we have one more question?
I guess.
Okay. Thank you very much. And let's hear another round of applause for Mario Schaff. Great program, and Lee and her center are to be commended for having it begin. Okay, I'm excited about the next topic as well, as someone who's done a very little bit of this, and there is nothing more fun than a day out on the... I'd love to be right in McCovey Cove when the Giants... Well, they probably won't need to come back to San Francisco, but in case they do, I'd love to be out there next Wednesday. So, our next... this presentation is entitled, Do You Want to Learn How to Sail Before the Tide Changes Too Often? With Kelly Gardner, the program coordinator of Challenged America in San Diego, and Tammy Earhart, who is a participant in Challenged America. So let's hear it for Tammy and Kelly.
Hi, you guys. Let me fix this. Can you hear me now? All right. Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm the program coordinator at Challenged America. We are a free adaptive sailing program for people with disabilities, all types of disabilities, right here in San Diego. We sail off of Shelter Island on the San Diego Bay. And our mission is to enhance the rehabilitation and education and recreation of people with disabilities and give them the opportunity to do something that they might not otherwise have. A little bit of history about our program. It was founded by two disabled veterans back in 1978 when they were sitting on the shore in their wheelchairs, saw some people sailing, having a great time, and decided that they wanted to do it. So they went out and bought themselves a boat. They modified it to be stable in the boat so they wouldn't fall over, and sailed for years and years and invited people to sail with them throughout the years. And it has been in several stages. Challenged America has been through several stages since then. In 2003 and 2005, they put together a team and a boat, and they sailed in the Transpac, which is a race across the Pacific from LA to Hawaii, finishing and being the first all disabled crew to do the race. Yay. One of the team included our co-founder, Urban Mayaris. I think a few of you in here probably know him. He couldn't be with us today, sorry. Okay, so now, today, we are sitting with a fleet of Martin 16s. They are an adaptive sailboat that is designed and built in Canada, specifically for the disabled. It's a two-person boat. We have a companion sit behind the participant and for instruction, safety, and to be their eyes. And all of the controls are right in front of the participant, all your lines, your steering, so you're able to control the boat all by yourself. Our companions are made up of all volunteers. Many of them have ASA certificates, which is a sailing certificate, and we train a lot of them to sail with the blind in-house. And In many different ways. Sometimes you might use a clock, sometimes, you know, like a 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, sometimes they might use degrees. They modify it to each person. A little fact I found out about racing. These Martin 16s, which they do have many disabled races around the country. All of the people with disabilities sail in the same race. They don't break it up into classes, you know, with blind and paraplegic. They all sail together, and when everybody gets in their boat, they have a companion and then the sailor, and they situate themselves in the boat, and it is each is a seat with a back, so they're very stable inside the boat. And they situate themselves in the boat, and they are not allowed to move in the boat. Turn around, get up on the side, move anywhere. There is one exception, it is for blind people. When they are going downwind, they are allowed to turn around so they can feel the wind behind them. I thought that was a pretty cool thing. Going upwind is no problem. We have a fleet of our Martin 16s. We are sailing year-round out of Shelter Island. Our participants learn how to sail all by themselves. Sail the boat and control of the boat. And many of the people who have sailed with us come back to the dock not knowing that they would do it themselves. They said, wow, I thought I was just going for a ride. You know, this was really cool. And a lot of them come back. The people that are sailing, people in groups that are sailing with us right now, are individuals, word of mouth. We also do group sailing days. A few of the groups we work with are the Braille Institute. We've had a couple days of group sailing for them. There is a junior group from the Bay Park Center for the Visually Impaired. They have a blast. They come every summer. And we work with the Sharp Rehab, Deaf Community Services. We're getting our flyers all out there, and we invite, you know, everybody to come down. A few of our participants that came down in groups, Sharp Rehab, for instance, loved it so much they ended up coming back. Now, we have a couple regular sailing days during the week, and these people come every chance they get. So last month, two of our participants and one of our companions went up to Canada and competed in the Mobility Cup in Vancouver. It was the first time that a team has represented Challenged America up there at the Mobility Cup. It's a big deal. It's a big race up there. And we're in the process right now of being a co-sponsor for the 2012 National Disabled Sailing Championships, which will be right out of Southwestern Yacht Club right here in San Diego Bay. That is really exciting. I don't know that they've had that in San Diego before. Another group that we sail with, a real exciting time, is also in September. The Veterans Administration started in 2008, started doing an annual summer sports clinic for the recently disabled veterans. About 100 veterans fly in from around the country and all meet up at the Marriott downtown, and they do sports, summer sports activities all week long all over the county, from kayaking and surfing, biking, sailing. So we are lucky and honored to provide the sailing venue for this event every year. It's the energy at this place is really exciting, and it's, you know, a great way to support our troops. A lot of young kids go through there. There are three parts to Challenge America. Really, there's the sailing, of course, our operations on the dock, getting people out on the water, and maintaining the boats. There is, of course, fundraising and donations. Challenge America has two employees, and all the rest are volunteers, from companion sailing to fundraising committees to ambassadors at boat shows. Our hard-working and dedicated volunteers, they really are our lifeline. Yeah, they're amazing. The third part is the volunteers, the part of Challenge America, number three, the volunteers. We couldn't do it without them. They're just, that is a big part of Challenge America. Today, I brought one of our participants, Tammy Earhart. She's been sailing with us since January. And she is going to tell you a little bit about Challenge America from her perspective as a sailor.
Everybody, my name is Tammy. I am a VIP, visually impaired person. I've been this way for about 3 years now. I have lost approximately 90% of my vision due to diabetes and trauma. It was the case of adding injury to insult. I have been sailing with Challenge America since January, loving every minute of it. I have to let you know that I'm afraid of deep water and I don't know how to swim. And, well, the thing is, and I'm going to get all teary on this, I used to be very much the introvert, very alone, didn't do a lot of stuff. I lost my vision. Some of those of you who may have lost your vision when you became adults or at a time in your life, you go through a major change. I was not a happy person. I didn't have a lot of family support, and I just kind of had to give myself a wake-up call one day and just get out there and say, you know, the worst has happened. I've lost my vision. I've lost my job. You know, what the hell now? But just go for it. And I got the, someone mentioned Challenged America to me, and I was like, no, I don't think so. I don't swim. I'm afraid of deep water. This is not going to happen. I don't like deep swimming pools. Finally, I went out there, and I had gained enough confidence to think, you know, I'll do this. I'll try it once. I actually went with my mobility instructor. We figured out how to get there, how to walk from the bus stop. That in itself was kind of fun. You can imagine Shelter Island on a warm, sunny afternoon, just checking it out for a few hours. As it would happen, once I got there, some of the staff and volunteers were having a meeting. So I got to meet them right off the bat. And I told them, I said, you know, I want to be totally hands-on. And that's one thing you can do if you should participate in Challenge America. It's what level you are interested in or you're comfortable with. Right off the bat, I said, I want to know everything. And literally, my first out on the dock, I had my hands all over that boat, asked questions, what's this, what's this, why is this like this, what's this going through here. The volunteers are very patient. Some of them have disabilities themselves, but they are quite capable of sailing boats, and in my case, being my eyes. And it was an awesome experience to get out there and be in control of this 16-foot boat out on San Diego Harbor, trimming the sails, learning about the lines, steering the tiller, And then getting the instruction from the volunteer companion. I mean, I'm learning the words. I can now sit at a dock somewhere and overhear a conversation, and I know what they're talking about. This is cool. It didn't all come at once. It took some time, but, you know, I know all about the Vang and the Cunningham and the Outhaul and starboard and port and all this stuff. Yeah, it's like Star Trek talk, you know, Vulcanese or whatever. But all the volunteers have just been really patient, very understanding. They're used to me knocking their hand away and say, don't do that, because I want to do it. I want to know how to do it. I want to know what it feels like. I have learned to do a pretty good job of keeping on course, using the wind on my face, the feel of the wind, the direction it's coming from, the feel of the sun on my face or my exposed arms, listening to the sound of the waves. The more water I hear against the boat, the faster I know I'm going. If it's not much sound, I'm like, oh, come on, this is not the e-ticket I was expecting. And you learn little things. I'm just amazed now at some of the things I can do out there sailing. I've literally walked across boats. We couldn't get my boat right up to the dock. I had to dock on the other side of another boat. I know those boats well enough now that I can walk across the boats to get to the dock. You know, I feel that comfortable now. Recently, a companion and I sailed a Martin from Shelter Island down to the Chula Vista Harbor. North of Coronado Bridge, not much, you know, it's kind of slow, not much wind. As soon as we got south of the bridge, it was like, whoa, Nelly, Kansas City. The wind, I mean, it was awesome sailing. We sailed basically wing on wing. That's another expression where we have two sails on the boat. We have the jib, which is, I'm sorry, we have two sails on the boat. A jib, which is a smaller sail at the front, kind of fine tunes where you're going. And then we have our mainsail, which is much bigger. And typically you have them both on the same side of the boat. When it's wing on wing or butterfly, they're in different directions. And it's very hard to get them to do that and stay like that. And they kind of stayed like that, and it was fun. But you know, it has really expanded my confidence level that I can get out there and sail this boat. I'm in charge kind of even of the volunteer. He's just there to keep me safe and give me instructions on what sailing is all about, like understanding that the wind is actually pulling the boat, not pushing it. I'm still having a problem with that concept. And then the occasional, you know, when you crusty sea captain who very calmly says, you know, there's a boat coming our way. I think we need to get out of its way. And as it passes, he goes, yep, that's a freighter. So, yeah, seriously, we are out there with those big boats, you know, and we have some of the tourist boats coming out, and they get up close to us, and you hear the clicking away of the cameras. I want to get a little sign that hold up says she's blind. I think that would be good. Take that back to Grandma in Newark, New Jersey. Yeah. The volunteers are just—they are amazing. They're awesome. They're very patient. We'll have Saturdays where they'll show up. There'll be more of them than of us, and they're very gracious in how they'll step back and maybe to one another volunteer and say, hey, you sail with her often, go ahead and do it. You guys are a good team. Or the other might say something like, you know, you had a chance to sail with Tammy, why don't you do it? I don't care who I get, I just want to sail. But I have a few favorites. We've connected in as far as really understanding how to sail. And as luck would have it, or God would have it, one of my favorite companions, his daughter, I think she's three now, she was born with glaucoma and doesn't have much vision. And I think he is learning that life from me. He's learning what it's going to be like, or what potentially will be like for her. I'm supportive toward him and his wife, encourage them, and saying, you know, let her be the daredevil if she wants to. Don't coddle her. Don't make her scared of life. Let her get out there, get her bumps and bruises, and just really experience what it's all about. You know, she can be anything she wants. And you just need to support that. Just like any parent, you got to step back at some point. And so not only is he giving to me, being out there and being supporting me, helping me through my experience of sailing and growing, I'm helping him through the experience that's going on in his home life too. And it's just a great combination. And when I get the chance, I like to give back to Challenged America. I myself and some of the other participants, students, we will go and do volunteer. We'll man the booth at like the Festival of Sail that we had recently. We've done the Harbor Days in Chula Vista, and it's just a lot of fun. We've really become a family now. And I hope all of you who get the chance to come out and sail do. Again, it's a free opportunity. If you live out of town, if you're not down here in the San Diego area and you're coming down on for vacation or something, give us a call and we'll set up an opportunity for you and your family members to come out and give it a try, see what it's like. And it could be in the future. Every time you're down here on vacation, that's what you're going to add to your itinerary. And there's no time commitment. It's just when you want to do it. Oh, and I'm very proud to say that my very first regatta, which is, you know, several races together, the Martin, I won first place overall. Thank you. And this has led to many wonderful other opportunities. Recently, a bunch of us went up to Dana Point, and I actually did my first open ocean race. I got to be the helmswoman. The rest of the crew was all sighted. And they have a computer, like a GPS system, that the sighted skipper helmsman was using to keep on course. So when I took over, I couldn't quite do that. However, he sat near me, and again, using the feel of the wind on my face, the sun, the echoes of sounds off the water, I stayed pretty well on course, and he very rarely had to tell me, you know, go 10 degrees starboard or port or whatever the case was. And everybody was wonderful. There were dolphins out there having a feeding frenzy, so that was just awesome. Just, I really couldn't see it. I could kind of hear it. They did attempt to get some of the dolphins to come over to the boats while we were actually racing. So just knowing, and then later on my Zoom text, I was able to blow it up large enough and see this massive blue doing thing. So it was cool. But I really encourage every one of you, if you don't already, get out there and just try. Not just sailing, anything. Go for it. You will be surprised at what you can do. I never in a million years thought I would get into sailing. Especially with my fear of water, that was not going to happen. And it pushed my limits, and it really took a lot of pushing. The limits I really had set were for myself, in my own head. It wasn't so much what the sighted community had set, it was what I had set in my own head. And you just have to get out there and do it and try it. And just, you know, you can do it anyone. That's all I can say. You can do anything you want. And I really think that, I personally think for me, my loss of sight was the best thing to ever happen to me. I have grown so much and met the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life. I've gotten to do things that I never wanted to do, thought I could do, had the opportunity to do. And I have seen, in return for what I have experienced, that I have been the spark in other people's lives. And I want you to do the same thing. Because when you give that spark to other people, it just lights a big fire in your own heart. So that's all I have.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank Thank you.
What a great testimonial to an organization. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Tammy. I wish we had time for questions. I don't know if you guys are going to be in the back outside of the room where people can talk to you, whatever, but I'm sure this is what a wonderful organization. Makes you want to move to San Diego, doesn't it? Makes me want to move between the sailing and the martial arts. But, you know, this has got to be really tough. Poor Joe Xavier, he comes on as a state employee, and he has to follow martial arts and sailing. That is really not fair. But being a man of substance, he will persevere. That's right. We probably should be nicer to him than normal just because. You know, I'm not going to, I normally don't read biographies of people that we know. Sometimes I think it is a little instructive to learn a little bit about a person who really has an awful lot going for them, who is working hard for those who are using the rehabilitation system. Joe Xavier is here today. He is the deputy director for the blind and deaf units within the Department of Rehabilitation. He is here with Kath Bales, who I'm sure is glad to be down here in her home area, Catherine being the head of Blind Field Services. Joe has over 26 years of experience in business and public administration, as well as many years participating in advocacy and community organization. As I said, he currently serves as the deputy director within the Department of Rehabilitation for Specialized Services, and he was as appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger in April of this year. Working for department, he's held many positions and directed numerous special projects, applying his exemplary leadership and managerial skills. He's a graduate of the Health and Human Services Agency Leadership Academy and a fellow for the Health Leadership Program at the Sierra Health Foundation, which is an excellent foundation in Northern California, and also in the University of Southern California School of Policy, Planning, and Development. His unwavering commitment to self-improvement drives Joe to continually seek out opportunities for leadership growth, and I want to commend to you a gentleman who, from the day he took his current position, has put in extraordinary hours and time to making the services that his department provides the best they can be. Joe Xavier.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Council. I'm kind of soft-spoken, so I want to make everybody at the back of the room can hear me. If you can, I'm sure you'll speak up. First of all, let me thank you to the Council for inviting us to be here. Thank you to Gene for reaching out and inviting us to come and present to the Council. Congratulations to the Council on yet another convention. Let me share with you, our Director Sauer and Chief Deputy Profasa were not able to be here. They, of course, send their greetings and best wishes for a convention. The other thing that I'd like to do... This has got to be it. I got to follow sailing and then get beamed by the fire alarm.
I don't think Joe's coming back next convention.
Yeah.
We'll let Matthias, the hotel manager in terms of our convention, give a brief announcement on that. And Joe can go over his notes some more.
Yeah. Folks, we had someone go through a door that they weren't supposed to go through up on the concierge lounge and area. And I think it was one of the hotel staff inadvertently. So we do have, unfortunately, yeah, we had folks check it out. And, you know, we've determined that we'd love for you to stay in this room and enjoy the rest of the conference today.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, go ahead, John. Sorry about that.
Well, no kidding. As this lady, this nice young lady, was describing her fear of water and sailing, I was sitting here listening to the presentation, and people that know me know that I'll take any cruise as long as the boat doesn't go in the water. So.
This is a test of his leadership skills.
So, fear of the water, and what was the presenter before? Stay focused, right? So at this time, I'd like to, and I thought a little bit about how to do this. I thought a little bit of how to do this, so.
Let's, you already have an inferiority complex.
Well, if I don't have one by the end of this, I sure could. Okay. If you are a DOR staff and you're sitting here in the audience, for the sighted people, please stand up.
Get up.
Okay? If you are a DOR employee, the Department of Rehabilitation employee, and you're standing up, for those of us who can't see you, how about a clap or two? All right. So, first of all, thank you for being here and for participating and contributing to the council and to the work that the council does. And thank you for all the work that you and your peers do every day to get persons who are blind and visually impaired to work or more independent so they can pursue work. So thank you for that. One of the things that I believe is important when we come out and speak to you and to other organizations around the state is to give you a good understanding of what the environment is that we're operating in today. So let me share with you a little bit about our current state of the state. Some of you may know some of this, some of you may have heard me because I've had to make this presentation a few times this month. Let's talk about the state budget, one of our favorite subjects for a short, brief period of time. First of all, over the past 3 years, we have had $103 billion, that's B with a billion, in reductions. Current year, 19 plus billion. And I'm rounding off numbers here, so if you're doing the math, good luck. $7.8 billion of the 19 billion is reductions. $5 million is funds to be appropriated by Congress, which are not yet appropriated. $7.8 billion is expenditures related. And $3.3 million is actions associated with projections, and $2 million in loan shifts, money that's shifted from one fund to the other. Health and Human Services, this is the agency that the Department of Rehabilitation resides in. I'm going to list reductions that have occurred in this budget for you. Aging, $6 million. Alcohol and drug, $18 million. Healthcare services, $384 million. Public health, $77 million. Developmental services, $30 million. Mental health, $82 million. Social services, $823 million. Child care, $374 million. You know what's really good about that list, if there's such a thing that you can say? It's Department of Rehabilitation is not on that list. But that gives you an idea of the environment that not just the state, but our agency, which is predominantly the Health and Human Services Agency, of what impact has been occurring to us. There's a $1.5 billion employee compensation reduction. For those of us who are overpaid state employees, you know, the favorite punchline of the media, $1.5 billion reduction. bargaining agreement savings and workforce cap make that up. Give you a little more specifics about the department. Well, first of all, before I say that, this is within days of the budget being signed. The Sacramento Bee, for current year, projected a $10 billion shortfall. Okay, so the list of the list that I read does not include what is going to be done to close the $10 billion gap. The hire freeze, I talk about workforce caps. The hiring freeze that was imposed remains in effect. We can make no hires. We are allowed to make laterals, no promotions, laterals within the department, which we're taking from one to give to the other. DOR key vacancies, and key for them that these are major leadership vacancies within the department. My former position, of which I still wear a hat of, the Deputy Director for the Independent Living and External Affairs Division, our Budget Officer, our Human Resources Management Chief of that branch, District Administrator for the Fresno District. Program vacancies exist in Blind Field Services, the Business Enterprises Program, and at the Orientation Center for the Blind. Furlough status. And as far as we know, today, they have ended. That does not mean that we won't have a Monday morning, but in as far as we know today, this Friday, people are at work, although I was told that some people thought it was still early Friday, so we're dealing with that. And this is not only good news, of course, for us who are state employees, but you know, for our business enterprises vendors who are in state buildings, and one of them over here very excited that people actually are coming to work, which means they're buying. The Social Security Services Administration has announced, again, the second year in a row, there'll be no cost of living adjustment. That's a major impact to the consumers that we serve. It's a major impact to our community of disabled people here in California. DOR budget. Since 2002, 2003, we have lost 350 positions. Current year positions, we have 1,183.4. I don't quite know what the .4 is or who it is, but this is government, okay? Now, in addition to having lost all of these positions, we are mandated to keep a 10% salary savings through vacancies. So the 1,883, an equivalent to 10% of the cost for those positions must be vacant. On a position for position, you're looking at what, another 188 positions that must stay vacant. DOR budget is $419 million. Our general fund is $56.8 million. The good news about not being on that list above, and we have a trust or a state fund of $56.8 million, is we're not high profile. The bad news is, when we get one of those, you need to reduce by 10%. Think about that. That's a huge number when it's $56.8 million. And that 10% reduction translates to another equivalent of $4 for every $1 of federal money. So it could be some $20, $25 million reduction that we have to endure. And in as far as the current year reduction from the general fund, we don't have any, but we are crossing our fingers every which way because we know this is far, far from over. The other thing that came with the budget is there are 11 state buildings that are planned to be sold. I mentioned that because in the enacting statutes, they clarified that daycare and that the cafeterias would continue. So there's a number of those buildings that are likely to have our BP cafeterias in them. And of course, were those to be sold, to be operated by someone else, but our cafeterias would continue. So that's the good news. DOR specific updates. This month is the National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and I'm sure that in each of our communities we've celebrated that. Frankly, it's not enough of a celebration because we need to get more and more blind and visually impaired individuals to work. Yes. And these days we'll take any accolades that we can get them. The Department of Rehabilitation received the National Council on Education Award for Excellence in Vocational Rehabilitation. So that was presented to the Department of Rehabilitation this year, and we had one of our deputies was back in D.C. last week or so and received that award on our behalf. So we're very grateful, and Fresno State nominated us for that. So thank you, Fresno State, and any alum who are sitting here. No offense to USC or UCLA, because I don't want to get into the Jeff and Mitch. Okay, 24.1% of DOR's staff are persons with disabilities. An equivalent amount are in leadership positions, managerial supervisors. I'm happy that it's 24.1%, but our director will tell you we'd like that to be 84.1%. So, which means if you are here and seeking an employment, when you see an announcement, before you see the announcement, get ready, apply. All right, let's talk about a couple of the things specific to the department. The electronic record system, which is a major change for the department in spite of all of the bad news that we're facing, is a project that continues. It's going to modernize our case recording system. That is moving forward, which is very good news for us. Let me skip through the details of that. Executive order, the governor signed an executive order this past July, and the Department of Rehabilitation is taking a key role, although we're not the lead agency by statute, we're taking a key role in helping implement that order. And it's going to essentially have three prongs that it's affecting. One is working with the Department of General Services to improve the procurement of goods and services for reasonable accommodations. And as a result of that, we also hope for all of our consumers, we just think there has to be ways to expedite that process. Two is to improve the accessibility of not only the IT hardware software, but the content that we see in all of our web pages. And if you follow this topic at all, you'll know that our Office of Chief Information Office released a policy letter prescribing greater efforts to accomplish that. Okay, stimulus. One of the good things is that California received 61 point something million dollars a year plus ago to spend. But you know, it is not easy to spend money when you don't have money to spend, and it came with such tight reporting requirements and such tight requirements that all of our communities are struggling. So let me give you some brief updates on that. One of the things that we have to do is a reporting to the federal government, and we have to do that closing quarter, which is September 30th. Very happy to say, in no small part to all of our partners, many of you who could be sitting in here, and I apologize, I just don't see you. 100% accuracy ahead of schedule. That was huge for us because it's been an ongoing struggle to collect the data and to get these systems into place to report that data. Are obligated $43 million and has expended $23 million. Independent Living has obligated $1.4 million and spent $400 plus of that, and this is the Independent Living Center's side of Independent Living. Older Individuals Who Are Blind program, $3.4 million, and we have spent $849,000 of that. Okay? Now, let me talk about some specific programmatic within the Specialized Services Division. For the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program, for our federal fiscal year that just ended, September 30th, we have an excess of 100% of the match necessary for, quote, normal and stimulus dollars. That's huge, because that was something that had to be put into place, and not only into place for the normal dollars, but for all of the $3.7 million of stimulus money. So there's a Joe Smith who's in here, Catherine Bales, and a number of other staff have spent countless hours. We achieved that goal. Thank you very much.
We're very well underway for the match necessary for the current federal fiscal year to having all of that match in place. So that's very good news, and thank you to all of our partners across the state who are participating in that. We engaged the Blind Advisory Committee. They met this past couple of weeks ago, October 13th, I believe. We have engaged them in a discussion to do three principal things here. One is to establish the service area for OIB in California. So, and essentially, how are we going to distribute the geography of California within service areas so that we can then determine how to allocate funding for each service area, and then how do we allocate the distribution of that funding within the service area. The OIB is a program that has evolved over time, and we believe that this is an appropriate time to better align those SSEs, and particularly because the grants were just awarded, we just awarded 24 grants to 17 agencies. And what that means, for those of you doing the math, is that some agencies are providing coverage in multiple areas. But one of the things we also know is not all the state, all the geography in the state is receiving services, and there's always an ongoing call, we need more money in this area, we need more money in that area. So we believe it's time to step back, and what we want to do is work with our community, with the Blind Advisory Community, and we'll be holding other forums to make sure that we do it in a transparent and with all of the input and contributions from all of our interested parties. The stimulus money continues, particularly in the older individuals who are blind program. We're very concerned about the ability to spend that money because this couldn't have been the worst thing for all of our communities. We get all this extra money, that's all good news. But the way that this works is that we give an organization money, they create a service that they provide that service, they pay the bill, they invoice us, we reimburse it. So we provided all this extra money at the same time that all of their reserves are being depleted, their cash flows are very difficult, so they're struggling to do that. And so we have brought on some extra staff to assist, and we have four key principles that we're operating in. Number one is we do not want to return money to the feds. Okay. Now, you know, I mean, that is simply something we do not want to do. Now, to avoid that, we are working with each of our current recipients to find different ways, different methods, different processes, different machinations to help them spend the money they have. That's our first priority. If we can find any way to help anybody spend the money they have, as long as it passes the test, it has to pass the test, of course. We want to do that. Where that's not possible, identify what monies we need to bring back. Identify what we're going to use those monies for. Now, here's the real challenge. All of the money has to be spent by September 30th. We're in November. We don't have a lot of time. And so we asked the Blind Advisory Committee, we've asked a number of our community partners to assist in identifying short turnaround projects that we can spend funds on in a short order. And I say that because those of you who know anything about government, when you have to put out an RFA and then you go through the whole process, you also have to provide the organization time to put into place whatever it is that they said they can do. So we're struggling against the clock and against the number of other variables that we're trying to through. The Business Enterprises Program. The Marine Corps, we submitted this past May an $866 million proposal to serve five Marine bases here in California, one in Arizona. It's a partnership between the state of Arizona, California, six blind vendors here in California, and one in Arizona. And today, still awaiting on the fate of that proposal, all we can get from the Marines is we're still working on it. It was supposed to have been done and awarded to be effective in October. Obviously, that's not happening. Our best guesstimates is to hope to hear something December, January. No certainty there. But it will provide a tremendous opportunity for six of our vendors who have been selected for this to improve their opportunities, their livelihoods. And then, of course, where they are provides opportunity for other vendors. The BP vendor conference was held October, I think, 8th, 9th, 10th, and I don't know if Roy Harmon is here, who's the chair.
of the California Vendors Policy Committee. So congratulations to Roy, to Deb Meyer, our program manager, and to the team. It was a very successful conference we had. So, we had some 60-plus vendors that came together, educational conference, and I had the opportunity to attend the banquet and then also to participate in a presentation their day. So congratulations to you. We shared with the let me step back a second. One of the things that when I first came to this position is how can I do, what can I do, what do we need to do, how do we need to do to help BEP become what it can be. And, you know, I look at a lot of the history of BEP, and for those of you who don't know, I have a little bit of history with it, starting as a vendor back in 1983 or 4, and then there's a number of you in here who have been in that program as well. So one of the things for me that I struggled with is, where are we going? And so I started to ask the question, tell me what this program looks like in 2020. And when I get the answer, that's a good question. Translated usually means I don't know or I'm not sure. And that's not a good way to go because we don't know. We can't get there. So I sat down with the program management and we drafted a vision. We vetted it with people within the department and we shared that vision with the Vendors Policy Committee on August 19th. We subsequently shared it with the vendors at their conference, and we shared it with the Blind Advisory Committee this past meeting, and we'll also be sending it to the leadership of CCB as well as NBC because we want input from everybody. And before you ask me for it, it's in my room, so I'll have to run up and get it. I forgot to bring it down. I also sat back and thought about, okay, BEP has an awful lot of things that need to be done, and how do we decide what to do? Because there are more priorities, there are more projects. And one of the things that I shared with the committee was an inventory list of projects that's some 70 plus things that need to be done. This is over and above the everyday functions of the program. These are things that we need to tackle to resolve. And so as I thought about that, and I said, okay, now how do we decide what to do? So along the same vein, in the same spirit, we constructed a criteria by which to prioritize the program's needs. And we've shared that with the same parties, and we welcome the input to strengthen that, and we'll continue to move that forward. There have been a number of stimulus sites or sites using ERA stimulus dollars to be developed, and a number of those have opened. The LX, the vending machines there, Boron, Camp Roberts, and a number of other places have been opened. Again, it's not only an opportunity for an existing vendor, but those vendors came from continues to be another opportunity. Since January of this year, there have been 18 announcements for new locations. That means 18 vendors had an opportunity to either go to work or to improve the locations that they were in. As of the end of September, BEP had 108 vendors operating 136 locations. 62% of the BEP vendors have less than $3,300 take-home money on the average. That's simply not good enough. There's a lot of reasons for that, and there's a lot of discussions about what we need to do to improve that. And of course, as we pursue the Marine Corps and some of the locations that I mentioned, that also gives us the opportunity on the other end to say this location just is no longer viable. New contracting terms and conditions have gone into place over the recent past to strengthen the collection and the compliance for vending machine commissions, so we're very grateful for that. In one instance, we collected about $38,000 from someone who owed the program commissions. BEP, you know, BEP's got to be the best kept secret because every time we talk to people, it's like, what's that? And yet we talk about it, it seems like forever. So Deb Meyer, who's our program manager, and Catherine Bales teamed up and delivered an awareness and informational session to all of Kathy's staff. We invited other department staff, including counselors from all of the other Employment Preparation Services Division, to become, again, more aware and more informed about BEP because it is an opportunity for employment. Now, grant you, it has to be somebody who wants to be truly an entrepreneur. It's self-employment. And it's self-employment in one of the most difficult industries, a perishable industry. Cash, perishable, and self-employment. That's not for the faint of heart. But I will tell you, as someone who had that opportunity, it changed my life, and it can change many lives. But you're not going to get up at 8, and you're not going home at 5. If you are, you're not going to be successful. But if you choose to work, it can be a very lucrative income. New program regulations went into effect September 15th of this year. Sure. Blind Field Services. Consumer served, fiscal year 2009-2010. 1,629 referrals, an increase of 2.9%, same time period. 1,429 new plans, an increase of 2.6%. I'm sorry, I got numbers here trying to. 766s, an increase of 29.5%. A 294-28, which is unsuccessful closers, which is a decrease of 43.5%. 44,917 open cases, which is an increase of 3.9%. New hires in Blind Field Services include 6 counselors, 3 supervisors, and I know Kathy is very happy for that, because for the longest time, her supervisory ranks were very thin. So she was able to fill, and when she had the opportunity, she was quick. Rehabilitation specialists, and then the SB 105 training is being planned for May, and I believe it's May 4th. I'm sorry, April.
April 4th, 5th, and 6th.
4th, 5th, and 6th of this coming year. And we have members of the Blind Advisory Committee participating in the development of the curriculum and the planning of the training. We just awarded 3 contracts for employment development preparation, and they went to the San Francisco Lighthouse, the Junior Blind of America, and BSSI Blind Service Support Services Inc. Peter Benavides, and out in the desert area. And then the question that I drive Kathy crazy with is, what do we need to do to get 800 competitive closures? What do we need to do? And that's the question I keep driving her supervisors crazy with, because we need to get to 800, and I've told her when we get to 800, that won't be enough. I'll change it to 1,200. The point being, every Californian who is blind or visually impaired that wants to go to work should go to work. So we need to find a way to make that happen. Orientation Center for the Blind. Okay, construction. I think this was reported at the April conference up in Burlingame. We're going with the stimulus money that came to California. We have a unique and rare opportunity to do maintenance and upgrades on that campus, which was built about the day I was born. And it's been quite a while. So a couple of the things about that. The campus is going to, well, first of all of the contracts are in place. The clock started ticking on October the 18th. The shovel in the ground was this past Tuesday, and we're hoping to have that work done. The contractor says July. It has to be done by September. If he's done in July, hallelujah. If he's done in May, even better. But there's an awful lot that's going to occur between now and that time frame. Let me give you just an idea of what's immediately ahead of us. The campus is going to be closed to students November the 19th through January. Keep in mind that the one thing about construction is there's not a lot of certainties. You run into things happen. So I'm sharing these timelines with you, and we're building in some float because things can happen, and we'll keep our fingers crossed and a prayer and a few other things to make sure we stay on schedule. But the campus will be closed to students for that period of time. Staff are not being laid off. Nobody's being terminated. What we're doing is working with the individual staff to develop different plans for leave usage, training, and a number of other support activities that need to occur during that period of time. And what's going to happen, the reason the campus is being closed to the students for that period of time is because there's some major pieces of equipment and work that needs to be done in the kitchen area, which takes out the food service. The elevator that's going to be installed in the dormitory requires that we do some excavating, some other more significant projects that need to occur with the infrastructure. So it just seemed like an optimal time to do the heavy work, and we're going to close the campus to the students and those that are day students, and we'll be still continuing to provide some services to them as well. One of the things that is a benefit out of this renovation, this upgrade, and I have to use the right terms, it's not a renovation, it's a maintenance and upgrade. As Jeff chuckles because he knows the system too well. The outcome is going to, the result of this will allow us to put in a computer lab, which will allow us to improve technology availability and training to the students. This is also going to provide an opportunity to upgrade our curriculum. We've already met with the OCB advisory board, and there are more meetings to come. Training in each student's media of preference, training in management and budgeting is some of the basic needs that we need, you know, how to manage your checkbook, keep the cash in the wallet, those kinds of things. Independent living, one of the things that will occur is that there will be now an opportunity to have an apartment setting on campus so students can build their independent living opportunity and independent living skills in that way. More instruction for online shopping and some of the other online activities that we all get to do these days. Classes and activities, which include yoga and dance and a few other things, are being looked at and planned. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks, Mr. President, and thank you for having us here.
All right, thank you. Let's see. And I'll let Mr. Pomerantz ask the first question.
Joe, I want to give you a lead and ask you a question. First of all, it's just come to my attention that you're going to be setting up a facility at LAX. As a former employee of the City of Los Angeles, and that was one of our facilities, I'm really pleased. Perhaps you can give a few more details. And the lead I want to give you is this. After at least 30 or more years, there were two facilities, one in Los Angeles City Hall proper, one in LA City Hall East. They were run for decades by the American Legion. Most recently, they were run by a private vendor. I was over there a few weeks ago. Both of those places are vacant. I hope you would contact the appropriate person at the department, LA City General Services Department, because I thought for a long time that they'd be perfect locations for a vending facility. And you now have the opportunity.
Okay, thank you. And Mitch, with LAX, we actually have a vendor in there operating. And I'm sorry, I don't recall, if anybody here may know the vendor, I don't recall who.
Elvia.
Okay. So Elvia is in there operating vending machines. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of challenges that we had to go through. And I'm not sure that, you know, all of the bugs are worked out. The good news is she seems very ready and very prepared, and from what I'm hearing is doing a good job. So we're looking forward to not only being the only opportunity at the airports.
Which terminal, Joe?
Yeah, like I would know that. Sure. How many terminals are there?
Seven, eight. Yeah.
So here's my answer.
I
have no clue.
She means four terminals.
One more here.
Four terminals, I hear, yes.
Terminal four.
Oh, wait a minute. Terminal four or terminals?
Four terminals.
Four terminals.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Roger, go ahead.
If we're through with this debate on terminals.
Yeah, go ahead.
If this is a terminal debate.
We've terminated this, yes.
Joe, you are in a very unique position to give me some advice. I, as you know, am a long-term CCB-er and all that, ACB-er, and I'm now a member of the board of the Silicon Valley Independent Living Center. You used to be the deputy for independent living, now you're the deputy for specialized services, so what advice do you have for me?
Talk to me after the meeting.
Well, that's a loaded question if I've ever heard one.
I have a question. Sacramento Airport is building a new terminal. What about that for a location? Have we tried to get into that one?
Good question.
As I said, I think LAX...
I need some upward mobility.
As I said, I think LAX is first. I certainly hope it's not the last, but let me remind you of a number that I put out. 108 vendors operating 136 locations. We need more vendors. This is not for the faint of heart. It is one tremendous opportunity. Self-employment, cash, and perishable.
And go, go, go.
Yeah. And Joni knows all about it because she uses roller skate. Oh, roller something. What was it, Joni? Oh, sorry. Okay, I won't tell. To get around to all her different sites. But it is, you know, it's not for everybody. Let's face it. But not all of us are, no offense, Jeff, meant to be a nice. Okay. Not all of us are meant to be bureaucrats. Not all of us. We all have our calling. But if you are at all an entrepreneurial spirit and you don't mind hard work, this could be tremendous for you. On the other hand, if you don't like either of those, well, then you don't want to do this because it's no fun either. And I say that because that is truly something that pursuing locations, we have to have people to run them. And I have an unfortunate circumstances that we're dealing with in Sacramento where we spent significant resources getting a location ready, not so much interest in operating it. That's not good news.
All right, any other questions? Okay, we now stand in recess until 7. Just want to tell you, all the at the registration table will be the business cards for the sailing and the thumb drives for the Access San Diego. So feel free to go and gather them at the registration table. We now stand in recess till 7 p.m. 7 p.m.